The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The DC Planned Parenthood, we were prepared to do our street painting as part of our Black Preborn Lives Matter campaign. And we came out here and were told that we would be arrested if we started painting on the street. And that's obviously really unfortunate news because we just want to express our First Amendment right, as every other group has been painting in the street. We know that the mayor has allowed other groups to paint in the street, whatever their message is, and that's exactly what we came out here to do today. But, you know, maybe based on the location, based on the message, we were told no, and our students were told that they would be arrested for doing the very same thing that other groups have done.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. So many different things to talk about today. We've got a great show lined up for you. The voice you just heard was about Students for Life. We're going to have Kristen Hawkins on a little bit later on to talk about that same event where they had three students arrested for painting on the street. And that case continues. It's been a year. We're going to be talking about that a little bit. I know that there's the big news this afternoon is the sexual harassment report on Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York. There are now bipartisan calls for his resignation. He is insisting that he's not going to resign. We don't really have too much on that today, but I would suggest that we're probably going to be talking about that issue for quite some time, and I don't think we're going to get clarity on where the state of New York is going to go from here until probably later on down the road. But certainly an interesting story that's percolating. It just happened within the last hour or two before we went on the air on this show. And I think it's certainly going to be taking up our attention later this week. Sheila and I are both still filling in for Drew this week. So Sheila will probably get to it tomorrow, and I'll probably be doing something to follow up on Friday. So, you know, stay tuned. That story is only going to keep developing. And right now, however, in this hour, we're going to talk about something that I think most parents and probably most grandparents are concerned about, which is this divide, this generational divide on faith in God and in faith in the church. And this is, I think, something that's very concerning for anyone who's got younger children, teenagers, young adults who are going through college at this point in time, probably especially. There seems to be a real generational split developing on the breadth of faith among American students. Here to talk about that is Brendan Hodge. He's a professional pricer and has spent the last 20 years holding pricing and data and analytics roles in a variety of companies, including Dell's, Wendy's, and Scott's Miracle-Gro. His novel, If You Can Get It, was published in 2020 by Ignatius Press. He's a graduate of Franciscan University of Steubenville, has lectured at the Professional Pricing Society, covered economics on the Sunrise Morning Show, and he blogs at Darwin Catholic. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on, and I understand that you're a fellow Texan.
I lived in Texas for about 10 years, but I actually moved up to Ohio about a decade ago.
Oh, there you go.
Not a Texan anymore, sadly.
See, I moved to Texas this month just because I heard you were here, Brendan. I mean, that's terrible. No, I'm just kidding around, of course. Brendan, great to have you on here. This is a tough topic. At the Pillar, by the way, pillarcatholic.com is where this at. You have a piece here that says the kids are not all right, a look at U.S. religious belief and practice. And I think we all, as we've gone through different generations, I think we've seen younger people fall away from the church to come back to it. You know, if they have that grounding in the church, they do eventually come back. But I don't think we've seen declines of the type that you're laying out here. And I don't want to be too, hyperbolic about this, but this is a concerning trend, is it not?
Yeah, and what was really fascinating to me in this data set is that this is coming from the General Social Survey, which is a really interesting data source out there maintained by sociologists. They do this big survey once every 2 years, and they've been doing it since the 1970s, and a lot of the questions are consistent. And one of the questions that they ask is about religious belief. They say, which of these statements do you most believe with in? And it ranges from, I know that God exists and I don't have any doubts, all the way to, there is no God. And then it's got various statements of kind of doubt or uncertainty in between. And what you see when you look at the overall data set is that Americans are more likely to be atheist or agnostic now than they were back in the late 80s when they started asking those questions. So it went from 5% who said either there is no God or I don't know if there's a God and I don't think there's any way to find out, up to 12% of Americans are now atheists or agnostics. And the percent who said that they were certain that God existed went from 62% down to 54%. But that's kind of the overall number. And the thing that really surprised me is when you break this apart by generations and you look at people born in different decades, the differences become a lot more stark. If you look at members of the greatest generation, people born in the 20s and 30s, about 70% of those people say that they feel certain that God exists. Whereas if you look at the very youngest people in the survey, in 2018, those were people born in 2000, and only 32% of them were saying that they believe that God exists. So as you move down through those generations, the number of Americans who say they feel certain that God exists has dropped by about half.
What's interesting to me when I'm looking at this data, and again, you can find this at pillarcatholic.com. I'm looking at this data, and you would, I mean, at least I would have expected sort of the baby boomer generation and people who were born in the 60s and 70s, maybe even a little bit in the 40s and 50s, would probably have started off lower. That is not the case, though. I mean, that cohort has been tracking more or less in the same general region as the two generations before it. It's really the cohort that were born in the 1980s that started off lower and has been sort of leveled or dropping off ever since. And that's perhaps not entirely, but at least some of that is probably are the parents of this cohort that you're talking about, which is, you know, started off below 50% and has been dropping off ever since.
Yeah, that was really surprising to me. I mean, as an active Catholic, I know a lot of people who are converts or who are reverts, and you read a lot of stories about people going through conversion experiences. You also know people who have fallen away from the faith. And so I really expected that what this would show would be like generations increasing or decreasing in level of belief. And I mean, obviously that's going on at an individual level, but it surprised me how steady each generation is. I mean, to see that people born in the, you know, 40s through the 70s, really, you have this very steady level of belief. And what changes is that younger generations are the ones who are showing up saying, I feel less certain that God exists. That was very surprising to me.
What do you think are the reasons for this? I mean, I don't know how this GSS survey is structured. Do they go into sort of, what do you want to call it? Maybe like free form responses? Do they do any sort of like word association type of things, the types of things that are more open-ended to give people a little bit more of a sense of where this is coming from?
No, they don't, unfortunately. And it's a very broad survey. So the religious questions that I'm looking at are just kind of a part of what they talk about there. They also talk about people's family lives and their political beliefs, kind of a lot of different things. So it is a really cool resource to do research on. One thing that did strike me is that as I was diving into looking at Catholics in particular, because it's a broad survey, but you can also filter it down to look at just people who either grew up Catholic, regardless of how they describe themselves now, or you can look at people who describe themselves as being Catholic now, or you can, you know, zero in on other groups, just depending on what portion of the population are, you may get a really small group. But when I looked at Catholics in particular, one of the things that really jumped out at me and was actually different from when I tried looking at Protestants is that whereas, as you said, the number of Americans who say that they believe in God, and it's similar for Catholics as a group, has been pretty steady from the greatest generation all the way through the baby boomers. The thing that really stood out to me in terms of a generation gap among Catholics is that church attendance dropped a lot between those generations for Catholics in the U.S. So if you look at people born in the 20s and 30s, about half of them go to church weekly. But then when you start looking at people born in the 40s and 50s and those, so that baby boom generation, it's more like 30%. When you look at people born in the 60s and 70s,
right,
that drops to about 20%. So there's a big, big drop off. And those are the parents of those people who are now believing at much lower rates. And so I think maybe you're seeing some change there, in that there was a drop off in American religious practice a while ago, but that didn't change into a drop off in religious belief until a generation later.
And again, we're speaking with Brendan Hodge. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149 if you want to join the conversation. You know, I'm just looking through, I'm a charts guy, I'm a data guy, and I'm looking at these charts, and, you know, there's always, you know, what do the charts tell you? What do the charts not tell you, sort of thing? You know, what, because you know this better than anybody. You know, you can get a good grasp on what you are measuring. Sometimes you don't see what you're not measuring. And in this case, I mean, it looks pretty comprehensive here. Do you see any holes in this in this data that might say, well, maybe we're missing some context, or is this really the way it looks at the moment?
So the thing that I really wish they did here is track individual people over time, because what this gets you is they're not actually talking to the same people in every survey. Even if they were, you can't track person to person. So what I really wish you could do is see the progress of an individual person's belief over time, and also see how that relates to their parents and how they were brought up. Because I think there are kind of some suggestive elements to this. It looks like broadly Americans dropped in religious practice as you got into the 70s and 80s, and that resulted in the people who grew up in the 80s and 90s having different religious beliefs than their parents. But what we don't know is, I mean, were people who were brought up practicing very actively, are they a lot more likely to believe than their parents? I mean, I think those of us who are raising our kids that way would sure like to think that, but we also know of cases where that's not true. And so you really wish you could track that and draw some general conclusions. And unfortunately, that this just doesn't give us a view into that aspect.
You know, and I do know that there have been longitudinal studies about this, not just in terms of religious faith, but very broadly in terms of social science. At one point, I was one of the subjects of these things, and I just got to be about in my late teens or early 20s, and thought I just can't be bothered to deal with these long questionnaires anymore. So, I stopped attending. I stopped attending the study, I guess. So, you can blame me for not having more data on things like this. But those types of studies do exist. I'm curious as to whether anybody's really focusing on faith issues in any of those social science longitudinal studies. But I know that the studies exist and they're very worthwhile. I think that the thing that really jumps out at me here too, and again, I think it really does come down to mass attendance, which is, and you put your finger on this, is that our grandparents were pretty faithful about going to church. I mean, not perfect. I mean, even the greatest generation, that's somewhere around, you know, percent raised Catholic who attend church one or more times a week. It's still sort of up and down around the 50% line, and and the next generation is more around the 30% line. But yeah, you get down to these more recent cohorts and it's really 10%. And I think we see this, I think we see this when we go to mass, right? I mean, right now it's tough to judge because so many parishes are still dealing with some types of restrictions. There's still in some dioceses, there's still dispensation is the word I'm looking for regarding the pandemic. And so it's tough to draw conclusions based on what you're seeing with your own eyes, but, and that's anecdotal rather than data, but I think we've all seen that, you know, church attendance gets smaller and smaller and trend older and older as well. And I think we're seeing this in the data. I think this data actually is sort of reflecting our experiences in the parishes.
Yeah, I mean, I know that one of the things that I've heard from diocesan staff and from priests is that if they look at kind of the records that they keep, obviously, you know, they do the occasional sort of parish census to figure out how many people are actually attending. But the statistics that they keep centrally are on sacraments. And so they're tracking the number of marriages in the church, baptisms right. in the church, and so on. And the thing that I know that really alarms a lot of our Catholic leaders is that when they look at how many people are actually being baptized into the church, it's really, really low. And so their concern is that you've got people who are going through First Communion, being confirmed, and then we basically never see them again. Or maybe they'll come back and get married in the church, but then won't even bring their kids to be baptized. And so there's that kind of one-way generational gate where you've got people who are doing some very low level of practice to satisfy like a parent or a grandparent, but they don't themselves make it a priority. And that is the kind of thing that creates generational fall off. And it's a big problem for the church. Cause I mean, not only for the institutional church of kind of who's going to fill those pews, but I mean, if you think about the mission of the church, which is to bring people the message of Christ, if they're not there, they're not hearing it. And
right.
if you don't have a missionary spirit to get out to those people and start to bring them back in, then you really are kind of failing in the mission.
We are speaking with Brendan Hodge, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, especially if you're a parent or grandparent who's got concerns about the younger generation falling away from the church. Let's go to Therese in Chicago. Welcome to the show, Therese.
Hello. Thank you. I want to hear, I'm waiting for you got someone to like identify the correlation. If you've got this downward trend and lack of attendance, lack of belief in God, what precipitated this?
That's a great question. I mean, it really is a great question. Is this a cultural decline? Is this, is there an initiating cause for this? And I'm not sure that we're going to get that from the data itself, but I think, Brendan, this is one of the things that we need to do some follow-up on, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I would say that there's a sense in which, as you look at this data, and I tried looking at this for Protestants, and I tried looking at it for Catholics, I guess two things stood out to me. One is that every form of religious belief or even lack of religious belief has a problem over the last couple generations with passing on those beliefs to children. So you see for Protestants, for Jewish people, it's small numbers, but even for Muslims and so on, you see drop off among younger generations who are not following their parents' beliefs. Oddly enough, you also see among people who are brought up with no belief, you've got about 30% of them becoming religious. So there's sort of rebellion there too. So you see this breakdown among Americans as a whole, but I think that what we do see is that among Catholics, it really stood out pretty starkly. And the thing that was interesting to me there is that of all the different religious traditions that were actively religious, Catholics dropped off the most in their belief in God between that period of the baby boom, so people born in the 40s through the 60s, and these younger generations of people born in the 80s, 90s, and further. So Catholics kind of were following the American trend, but more so. And I think there, I mean, you could spin a story about how, I mean, sort of collapsing catechesis, collapsing vocations, a lot of the confusion that reigned because Catholicism was going through a major set of changes within the church post-Vatican II at the same time that there was massive confusion in American society as a whole during the 60s and 70s. And so maybe there was kind of a gap in our armor, if you will, because the church was resetting at the time that a lot of other cultural things were resetting. But we are, as Catholics, very much part of a broader cultural trend here where it seems like everyone has struggled to pass on their faith to their children. It's just that Catholics seem to have had the hardest time.
Very interesting. Let's go back to the phones. Greg in Fort Myers, Florida, welcome to the show.
Yes, my opinion is very quickly is as people get richer, there is less need. as the generations have gotten more socioeconomically advantaged, I believe the need for God has gone down, okay? The other thing I can point to is 9/11. 9/10, the churches were empty. I mean, I saw it. 9/11, you couldn't get a seat. I mean, it was standing room only. The people were out. They weren't even in the church. They were outside listening to Mass. And I'm sorry, when trouble hits, people go to church. And whether it's dollars or terrorism or anything else, that's what drives people into the pews. And if I could just say this, when people start approaching the end of their life, I think they make their peace with God.
Greg, that's very good points, by the way. And I had the same experience as you did regarding 9/11. I mean, at the time I was working next to an evangelical church, a mega church. And I had never seen that parking lot fill up during the weekdays in the way it did in the days after 9/11. I mean, it was packed over there. And I do think that there, when people feel lost, they do turn back to God. And, Brendan, we got about a minute left. I mean, as we become more affluent, maybe this is what happens. People forget where all the goods flow from, right?
I know that has been kind of one of the big theories that a lot of modern commentators have presented, is that sort of affluent people are just less likely to believe in God or to practice their religious faith. For the longest time, the U.S. was the big outlier on this. I mean, we're the most affluent major country on earth, and yet we have very high rates of religious practice. And so one theory would be is the U.S. becoming a lot more like Europe? And then I think the other question is, I mean, the U.S. has always had a deep and powerful religious tradition, and it tends to come in kind of these waves of awakening. So is there some sense in which religious practice in America is really needing to be reformed and revitalized to give people that instinct that when they are in trouble? And I mean, even when we're not convulsed in some massive problem, I mean, we all individually face trouble, that people will know where it is they need to turn to.
Well, Brendan, I think that's right. We're going to continue this conversation with Monsignor James Shea after the break. Brendan Hodge, thank you so much for being with us. If you're on the line, stick around. We'll get to more calls with Monsignor James Shea in the next segment. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
The Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Drew Mariani is here for you on Relevant Radio.
Of hotair.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We got full lines right now, so be patient, keep trying us. We're going to continue this conversation on the failing of the latest generation. Is the church failing this generation? Is the culture failing this generation? Is it a combination of all of these things, or something else? We've been just talking with Brendan Hodge about this. We are waiting for Monsignor James Shea to join us. But in the meantime, we've got lots of great phone calls. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Mike in Albuquerque. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I think the problem is the secular education that the kids are receiving. The Catholic schools are very expensive, and the rank and file Catholic kids, they go to the secular schools. And you can't expect them to come out of there with a whole lot of faith. It's kind of like when the schools don't allow the Bible, of course, any religion. But when you go to prison as an adult, they give you a Bible. I don't know. The church, I think, really needs to educate the Catholic children. We're part of the big three. The Muslims, they don't send their kids to these kind of schools.
Well, I think they do more and more, especially inside the United States. I think they actually do. And I think that's one of the reasons why, perhaps that's one of the reasons why they're having these same issues. And as Maggie, our producer, reminded me, Fulton Sheen once said that if you go to private schools, you can learn to fight for your faith. And I think that public schools, I mean, I should say. And I think that there's something to that. But I also think there's something to what you're saying, Mike, which is that we are placing our children increasingly in secular environments. I don't think we should necessarily be surprised to get secular outcomes from that. And now we do have Monsignor James Shea of the University of Mary with us. Monsignor, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Ed.
And, you know, we're right in the middle of this great conversation about dynamics of belief based on generations. We had Brendan Hodge on. There's this really great article at PillarCatholic.com that he wrote regarding some of the data from surveys that they're tracking on this, showing that the most recent generation born in the 2000s are the least likely to be in church, the least likely to be people of faith, to have a deep and abiding faith in God and belief in God. Yeah. And I mean, I when I look at this, I say, well, this is not a surprise. And I, being the optimist that I am, Monsignor, tend to think, well, this is sort of cyclical. I mean, if you go through, you know, as you go through life, when you're younger, you question things, you challenge things. As you get older, you start to come back. But this, I think, it looks a little different, at least. And my guess is that you're seeing this a little differently as well. You're especially because you're right in the educational front lines here.
Yeah. So here's what I'd say. You know, I'm in my mid-40s now. And I think that for a long time, my perspective was very much your perspective on these kinds of things, that it's natural for people to sort of wane in their religious belief and their practice, you know, when they're young adults, but that when you start having kids and you begin to establish your life in a more mature way, you go back to church, things get more serious for you on the spiritual front and all of those things. And I think in the study that you're referring to, we do see that with the older generations. You see a bit of an uptick, especially, you know, in the oldest generations as they age. You see an uptick in their religious practice and in the exercise of their belief. We're not seeing that as much anymore. And so I think we shouldn't expect that that's simply going to happen. And this study that we're referring to right now isn't the only study yet. I mean, there are lots of studies out there about the collapse of religious belief. America, the nation we live in, still remains one of the most religious nations on the planet, and we should be grateful for that. And so if you go, for instance, to Europe, where many of the nations over there, I studied in Italy for many years, traveled in France and went to England, many of these countries, Spain, Belgium, many of these countries were solidly Catholic or at least Christian until, you know, 100 years ago when there began to be this collapse. And now the collapse is very deeply felt. There's still a higher level of religious belief in this country, but it's on the wane. And I think we don't want to be trapped here by simple social analysis. It's important for us to pay attention to the data, but I think we need to dig a little bit deeper and say, what's changed? Why aren't we seeing that sort of optimistic trend of young people returning to faith and those types of things? And I think it's important for us to recognize that we've seen a very significant shift in the imaginative vision that undergirds our culture. In other words, there was a time when our society breathed with Christian lungs, when the gospel, whether people believed it very deeply or not, when the gospel was sort of part and parcel of the imaginative, meaning-filled landscape of the human mind and heart. And we were what we would call a Christendom culture in that sense. And I think in a generation, we've seen a major shift. Remember what Pope Francis has quoted, the Aparecida document, that we're not living in a age of change, like everybody says. We're living in a change of age, a change of the ages. In other words, we're transitioning from a moment In which there used to be elements of the gospel and the life of Christ and the moral teachings of the church animating people's minds and hearts to a strictly secular culture. That means that our strategies have to change, but it's not a hopeless situation. This is something that Fulton Sheen saw as early as 1974, you know, where he said
right.
That Christendom was ending. And so I think that, that there's something else going on here for us to pay attention to, but we need to hold fast to the heart of Christ. We need to continue to believe in the Holy Spirit. And also, instead of wringing our hands, and I know that you're not one to do this, and neither am I, instead of wringing our hands, we have to say, why did God put us, you and me and all of our listeners, in the world right now? And what are we
right.
supposed to do about it?
I think that's a great perspective, Monsignor Shea, and that's it's a good challenge to the rest of us. And I would also say that we probably need to take heart here, because I think the church has been sort of ahead of this, or at least on top of this. We've been hearing for the last few years, big emphasis from Rome on the new evangelization. And I think that that this emphasis is specific to this particular issue, that what this world now requires is a new evangelization. We can't just keep riding on what we did several decades ago and expect it to be to speak to people who are of this age. We do have to find ways to get people energized. We do have to find ways to catechize people better, but we also have to find ways to spread the word differently. And I think that this is what we're seeing here right now is sort of the challenge out here. Here's the challenge, how we're going to meet it. And I think that's a great point that you just made.
Yeah, well, you know, two things in response to that. One of the things, you know, one of the saddest things that ever happens to me as I wander through the world is that people will come up to me heartbroken and say, you know, our kids or our grandkids don't believe. They don't believe in God. They don't practice the faith at all. I don't even know what they believe. You see the heartbreak in these people's eyes because it means so much to them to have passed on the faith. And they say, what did we do wrong? They're so full of guilt and shame. What did we do wrong? We did everything our parents did. We got them their sacraments. We sent them to Catholic school. We made sure that they knew the faith. And yet they've wandered. They've collapsed. What did we do wrong? And I think it's important for people not to be so super hard on themselves in this respect, because the culture has shifted so much, so significantly, that the old ways of doing things, as you said, just aren't going to work anymore. And you can't count on the overall culture to carry you along the way that it used to be. I'll tell you, Ed, when I grew up 38 miles from the University of Mary campus here in North Dakota in a little town with 200 people. In fact, we weren't even in the town. We were on a farm couple miles north of town, and my parents raised 8 children on that farm, and in that little town, everybody was on the same team. My parents, my teachers, my coaches, yeah, the Catholic priest and the Lutheran minister, everybody was on the same team, and they said, we've got kids in our town, and we need to make sure, we've got 18 years, and all together, we're going to do it as a team. We're going to make sure that when they leave here, they're good, believing people. My younger brother is on the farm now, and he's raising 6 children on that farm. Holy cow, has the whole, I don't mean that as a pun, they don't have milk cows anymore. But holy cow, has the ground shifted under his feet? Everything is different for him now and for his wife raising their children. The whole thing, the whole structure, the cultural structure, which assisted parents in passing on the faith, has collapsed. So that's one thing. The other thing that I'll note, you know, in respect to the new evangelization, C.S. Lewis, you know, who wrote Mere Christianity and the Chronicles of Narnia and the Great Divorce and Miracles and all these great books of Christian apologetics and imagination, he said a long time ago, in reference to the task that we have of evangelization in the modern world, that the new evangelization, he didn't use these words because those are words of, you know, Pope St. John Paul II.
Right.
But he said that the task is different because we're living in the first post-Christian culture in history. In other words, when the first evangelization happened, It was like, he said, wooing a young maiden. It was like someone awakening to this new, fresh Christian faith for the first time, and people had never heard anything like this, and it was mind-blowing. Read the Acts of the Apostles and see how effervescent they were with this news that Jesus had risen from the dead and that his whole teaching laid out a whole new way of existence, a new life for people. He said, now we live in a culture which is post-Christian, meaning people think that they've heard the gospel, even if they haven't, and they think that it's boring, it doesn't have anything to do with them, and they're cynical. And so instead of like wooing a young maiden, C.S. Lewis says, it's like trying to win a cynical divorcee back to a previous marriage.
Right.
That's a whole lot tougher to do. At the same time, we live in a time which is bursting with intentionality of faith. And so when you see small groups of Catholics, or if you come here to the campus of the University of Mary or to another sort of faithful Catholic college, you'll see all kinds of young people who will make it impossible for you to lose hope. Because there's a vitality to the faith. The Catholic faith is still, after all these centuries, the youngest and the freshest institution on the face of the earth, because it's a movement of the Holy Spirit. It's not a man-made creation. And so it's going to survive, and it's going to thrive, but the circumstances are different, and we need to take stock of the times in which we live.
We are speaking with Monsignor James Shea and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Let's go to Sandra in Arizona. Sandra, thanks for being so patient.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I really look forward to your explanation and response to my question and comment. My concern is about the young family that was raised Catholic. I know many that have had children, and they have drifted away from the church for whatever reasons. Now that having children, they, of course, rings a bell. I need to have the children baptized, whether it's something from themselves that sparks this or a grandparent saying you need to have the babies baptized. And my question is, why does the church require, and do they actually require, that anyone, say, above 5 years old, I know in our diocese, or our parish anyway, anyone above 5 years old has to go to instruction for 2 years before they can just be baptized. It was my understanding that, unlike the other sacraments, and I've heard it said that if you knock on the door and ask to be baptized, you should be baptized. So I just need some help with this topic.
Sure. It's an interesting question, Sandra. I hadn't heard that before myself. I know that there's, you know, preparation, and there should be for confirmation. There's preparation for marriage. There should be a lot more preparation for marriage. I don't know that I've ever, and certainly for First Communion, First Confession, I don't know that I've ever heard of preparation for baptism unless it's like RCIA for adults, you know, first-time baptism for adults. Monsignor Shea, have you heard anything about that? And is that more or less a diocese-by-diocese decision?
Well, it must be partly diocese by diocese. It is important for us to remember that in the very, very early ages of the church, the catechumenate was a multi-year process. And so if we go back, you know, to sort of the time just after the apostles, it did take a long time to prepare for baptism. And that was part of, you remember this concept of baptism by desire. In other words, this was a theological concept which arose in that context in which if a person was preparing for baptism and then all of a sudden, you know, fell off a cliff, we could assume that the Lord would provide through baptism of desire because they were in the catechumenate. Or if a person was preparing for baptism and then was killed for their faith, that was baptism by blood. Both of these concepts, baptism of desire and baptism of blood, both of those arose out of a long catechumenate. Now, I think through the years and through the centuries, really, the church's practice has shifted from a very long catechumenate to a shorter catechumenate. An adult certainly typically goes through RCIA, you know, beginning maybe in the fall, leading up to the Easter Vigil under most circumstances. But a two-year catechumenate for a five-year-old, you know, I don't know the specifics of that policy, And I haven't heard of anything like that. But I will say that baptism is something serious, which should be prepared for, but also it's something serious, which is the portal of salvation. And so there's an urgency around making sure that one who is seeking baptism, that there's nothing that stands in the way of that person being baptized. That's really important. What Sandra brings up, though, is an increasingly... it's an increasing phenomenon. You know, we were talking about Christian society and Christian culture. North Dakota must be one of the last places in the whole world where we're starting to lose our grip on that, where it used to be everybody here was a Catholic or a Lutheran. Everybody, you know what I mean?
Right.
And now we're starting to lose that. And I am seeing that in our parishes, we're starting to baptize children later and later. And that's not a great trend because it used to be one of the most serious obligations for a parent was to get the child baptized as soon as possible.
Monsignor Shea, I'm going to have you hold on. I'm going to have you hold on right there. We got to go to break. When we come back, I'm going to have you finish that thought and maybe take a couple of more calls. We had some great calls in the queue. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show is here for you at 888-914-9149.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 50 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Full bank of calls. We've got tons of calls. We're also talking with Monsignor James Shea of the University of Mary. And you were, I had to cut you off. You were just finishing up a thought about baptism and people delaying baptism and why that might be part of, it might be at least contributing to some of the issues that we're talking about here.
Yeah, Ed, I always feel so bad for the hosts who have to have me on their show because I just go on and on. I just wanted to say
I got to tell you, speaking at least from this host, I love it when people come on and they actually have something to say. you're good.
Well, so Sandra was wondering about baptism, and it is very urgent that because baptism is the portal of salvation, that parents who have a young child have their child baptized as soon as possible. That's all. I think it's just really important.
I think so, too. And again, I think that it's through the sacraments, after all, that we're going to be revitalizing the church. I mean, regardless of what we're talking about, new evangelization, new platforms, it's through the sacraments that we come to know Christ, that we come to know the Holy Spirit. And so it's through the sacraments that we have to go. And so that's part, I think, of what's going on here is this sort of distance from the sacraments. If you're not going to Mass, you're not getting exposed to the sacraments. If you're not getting exposed to the sacraments, you're not vitalized by the Holy Spirit and able to sustain your faith. I'm not talking about the parents and the grandparents. I'm talking about the people themselves who aren't coming to the church. That's
right.
What I'm referring to.
And Ed, I would say that connects directly with what we were talking about before. For this reason, it's the imaginative vision of the culture which has collapsed. In other words, people used to have Christian principles and truths as the furniture of their minds. All that's been cleared out now, and even those of us who walk with the Lord, who are faithful Catholics, are strongly tempted to see the world in a purely materialistic way. And so if you have a sacramental mindset, you realize that it's not just an empty ceremony. You're not just pouring some water. You're rescuing a soul from darkness and ransoming it for God, that God is really working in the sacraments. The same thing, you know, in the same way that we've looked at studies on the practice of faith, there are all kinds of studies talking about the belief of Catholics in the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. Well, it is true that that's fallen off, but much more serious than that is the capacity to believe in the original, in the invisible world, that it's not just a symbol, that it actually is, that it is with sacramental vision that it's Jesus' body and blood, his soul and divinity. But that's very hard to grasp if you have a purely secular or materialistic mindset. So it's not simply a matter of people not believing. It's a matter of people not being able to believe because of their vision of the world and human life and what it's all about. Unless we believe that there's an invisible world which is more real than this one, we can't have faith.
It's about formation is really what it's about. And again, we're talking with Monsignor James Shea. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Connie in Eagan, Minnesota, whose name sounds oddly familiar. Connie, welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi, Monsignor and Ed. I'm a friend of your wife, I'm sorry.
Yes. Yes.
But anyway, I was listening to you gentlemen speak about this. And from way back when our three children were confirmed in the church in Eagan, they were told after confirmation that they could make their own decisions about going to church after that. And I think that was the wrong thing for them to hear because they all of a sudden thought, well, if I don't feel like getting up and going to church, I don't have to. And I'm not sure why that was told, but I remember it. There's so much involved in why our children are away from the church, and part of it, I believe, are the universities that are also have professors that are maybe even anti-Catholic speaking about different things. I know I've heard about some of this. And the other thing is, in Eagan and all around us, we are having mosques built now. We've never had to contend with so many Muslims. And, you know, I don't know if that is part of the problem, too, but it seems to be a lot of different things developing.
Well, Connie, great talking to you again, by the way. Connie is a friend of ours, and so thanks for calling in. And, Monsignor, I mean, I think I really wanted to, we've only got a few minutes left, and I really did want to tie this back into the University of Mary and Catholic education. And I think that if I was to highlight one concern about whatever is competing against, you know, faith, I would actually say it's secularism more than it is a competing religion. And Eagan is a very diverse community. You know, the Twin Cities are a very diverse community, and that's certainly true. But I think it's the almost the radical secularism, especially in the universities, but also in the, you know, the secondary schools, the primary schools. And I honestly think that that's got to be a large part of what's going on here.
Yeah, well, this is connected to what we said before. The flow of the water has changed. It used to be that the education that we offered was floating with the cultural current. Now, in order to have belief, to live and to believe as a Catholic, you're swimming upstream. And so it is the case, as Connie said, you know, she talked about how people were told that when they were confirmed, they could make their own decisions. Well, that's a kind of idea that confirmation is like graduation or something like that. That's not true at all. Confirmation is meant to be a moment in which, through an anointing, one is able to live fully an adult kind of faith. And that means that we're constantly allowing ourselves to be formed and shaped. And I'll tell you, the work of education is really important, because it is the case that when young people go away to school, when they come here to the University of Mary from the Twin Cities, we have so many young people who come flowing up here from the Twin Cities, or whether they go to the University of Minnesota or, you know, Illinois State or something like that, they're so impressionable at that age. And for them to have good role models of thoughtful, articulate people like the professors that we have here, or at other faithful Catholic colleges and universities, that makes a huge impact on them, because otherwise, you know, they might begin to become infected with ideas that are very anti-Christian. I think about certain strains of anthropology, visions of the human person, critical race theory. Those types of things are very deep in the curriculum of many of our universities and colleges, and they can do a lot of damage. We really work hard at a place like the University of Mary to make sure that we're not exposing young people to that, except insofar as we can prepare them to have a good response for it.
Well, I exactly. And I think that's one of the benefits of the University of Mary. We're coming down to the last minute here or so. We talk a lot about the church needing to improve catechesis. We talk a lot about needing to improve Catholic education overall. And it's true that Catholic education has really it doesn't have the same prominent position that it used to have, but that is that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't find it, and it shouldn't mean that that it's something that should be out of reach either in terms of being the primary education option for parents, or at least a good secondary strong program in your local parishes and dioceses to get that type of education.
Right. Well, Ed, let me say this. Christianity, from the very beginning, has been a fighting religion. You know what I mean? It's been a religion not for wimps and not for people who are weak of mind or weak of heart. And we see that in all the stories of the martyrs. And so sometimes when we begin to moan and groan about the way that things are going, we forget what price we promised to pay when we signed on to the gospel. Jesus never told us it was going to be easy or that our culture would be vaguely Christian and we'd be able to get along in it. If there's a time in which the culture or the society supports us in our efforts to evangelize and supports us in our efforts of raising our children well, that's good, but that's not something to be expected. I'm filled with hope for this time in which we live, as difficult as it is.
Monsignor James Shea, thank you so much. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.